Okay, so we'll hope for the best on Camtasia. As we said before the break, the last, or the second half of this lecture, is pretty much implementation details as to, again, if you want to sit down and write a computer program which implements one of these simulation models, generates something like traces, what are the big issues in your doing this? Okay. And what we'll see is that there's two primary issues. One has to do with generating time samples. So we argue that they're randomly distributed, but on the other hand, we're going to pick specific values out of that random distribution. So how do we do that? Okay. And the second one is in maintaining an event list. Okay, so what we saw in our example was that the way we moved our simulation forward was to look, see, what's the next event coming up? Okay. Now, intuitively, it's pretty straightforward. You're just, again, maintaining an ordered list. I have an event, it's going to happen at such and such a time, and I want it in order of the times the events are going to happen. There's a few implementation details which have to do with, well, in general, how is that sort of a list produced? Okay. So, before we do that, we're going to step back a little bit and say that, in general, the discrete event models fall into three classes: event advance, unit time advance, and activity advance. And so the event and unit time advance are pretty much what we've been looking at, in the sense that you have events that occur at a specific time, and somehow we want to just make sure they occur in order and sort out what happens to the system when each of these events occurs. Okay. Now, activity-based is philosophically a little bit different, in the sense that instead of having events as sort of the core of your system, you have activities as the core of your system. And the difference is, an event is something that happens instantaneously and changes the state of the system. An activity is something with duration. Okay. So if we think of our machine repair example, then there would be a number of activities. You would have the most obvious activity is obviously the machine being repaired. Okay. So it has sort of beginning and end and duration. Okay. And it can be linked to events in the sense that you can have a begin activity event, an end activity event. Okay. Similarly, if you're waiting in a queue, there's an activity of waiting in the queue. It begins and it ends and it has duration. Okay. We're not going to discuss the implementation of that. It's just, again, worth tucking in the back of your mind that some people, depending on what your problem is, if your problem is actually a lot of sort of jobs being done and sequentially or in some configuration, then it's not a bad way to represent it. Okay. What we are going to concentrate on pretty much solely is the idea of event advance. Okay. And in event advance, again, we sort of skip over time until an event happens. Okay. So we saw that we would go from one machine breaking down at time 3, then the next thing was the next machine breaking down at time 9, or whatever time it actually broke down at. Okay, so it's pretty much, it's an implementation detail in the sense it's going to be how you sort of write the logic of your simulator, but the understanding is just that you're jumping from one event to the next event to occur to the next event to occur, and at each of those event occurrences, then your simulator is making its decision about what other events should be occurring now in the future. Potentially, some events might not occur because something happens. Okay, that's a little more complicated and not something we'll go into, but potentially. Okay. And again, the core of this is going to be this ordered list of events that have yet to occur, that are going to occur in the future. Okay. In unit time event advance, it's similar in the sense that we want to catch events in the order that they're going to happen. But the method of doing this in unit time advance is we tick along our master clock, and at each tick we see, well, is there any event ready to occur? So as time progresses, we look and see what events are ready to occur. If it can be useful if events are sort of close together. It's philosophically quite similar, again, to the event advance in the sense that you're moving from event to event to event. There, again, are implementation details that are different, obviously. Again, here you're advancing, everything's run from the advancing of the clock first, and that causes, so the master clock advances, that causes the event clocks to advance as well. Again, for the event advance, the event occurs, and that has implications for the master clock. So if one event occurs at time 3, the next one at 9, then, well, the master clock has advanced by 6 time units between those events, and so you just update the clock as you go along. So it's which one do you take first, the clock or the event? Okay. So again, activity-based assumes that instead of representing activities, we're going to represent events. Instead of representing events, we're going to represent activities, and each of those activities has a duration. So if you're thinking about a queue, the activities are arrival into the queue, and so that has some duration. And so you would then represent how long at the arrival process was going to take. Waiting in the queue, again, you'd want to represent how long the waiting process was going to take. And getting service in the queue, you want to represent how long that's going to take. Yes?
Sure. Is the fact that it's more than one clock cycle work defined as an activity, or that theory that it has several parts to it?
The duration is what defines it as an activity. An event occurs instantaneously. Okay? And so you think it's like flicking a switch and something happens. In this case, you've got a bunch of things that each have duration. And so for events, well, certain events occurring trigger other events occurring. Similarly, with activities, what happens is essentially one activity completing triggers other activities starting. Okay. So again, you're either sort of matching up these entities with a duration, or you're matching up entities with a time of occurrence. And it's similar in a lot of ways. Again, this activity-based can be useful if the basic entities that you're trying to represent really do have duration. Like if you're on an assembly line, for instance, you know, at each station something is occurring, it's taking a certain amount of time, then you're moving on to the next thing occurring, taking a certain amount of time. But it's a different way of, slightly different way of representing the world. And obviously, where it becomes a big issue then is how you code it up more than anything else. Okay. So, again, activities have duration, and their completion triggers other activities happening. Okay, so to some extent, time then becomes measured by the beginnings and ends of the activities, rather than the occurrence of, again, the instantaneous event. Okay. Now, we're going to concentrate on event-based simulations. Okay. So, the output that we're looking for is going to be a sequence of events, and specifically that's the type of event and the time of occurrence of the event. Okay. Now, in order to implement these simulations, again, what we need to do is maintain a list of the events that are scheduled to occur. And what we're going to do at any time is look at the first event that's scheduled to occur, the one sort of nearest in time to the present, and then that will update clocks, and that will cause new events to be scheduled, or again, potentially old events in the list to be unscheduled. Okay. And so, sort of the core of the main data being maintained in this case is this event list. And so, in terms of implementation, what we need to do is keep track of this list, maintain this list. In terms of logic, well, logic is telling you sort of how this list is maintained, how you add events and to the list. Okay. And also embedded in that is that you will have to keep track of time. So when we pull an event off the top of the list, well, that will automatically indicate that a certain amount of time has elapsed and we need to handle advancing all the clocks within that. Okay, so what exactly are we trying to do? Again, we have our event list. We want to find the next event. And again, if we keep it in order, we're just pulling off the first event in the list. If we don't keep it in order, we have to search through and find what has the smallest timestamp. Okay. Then by pulling off this event, we know that we can calculate how much time has advanced. So how much time was there between the last event and this new event? We advance time according to that amount. Then we take a look at what the event was. Again, if it's an arrival into the queue, well, at some point that will trigger an exit from the queue. Okay. So the system state is going to change, and the types of the number of events is going to change. Okay. If we create new events, then we have to add those new events to the future event list, and then we go up and do it all over again. Okay. So that's pretty straightforward. Again, you should be able to sit down and code that up in some language. The biggest question, perhaps, is exactly how do we represent that list in some sort of computer language? Okay. So again, I'll ask for a brief show of hands. How many people have seen, heard of linked lists? Yeah, good. Okay, so maybe half of you. How many of you have used list constructors in Java, the list method? Okay, so another third of you or something. Okay, so you've seen probably in either C or Java some way of implementing lists. Okay. How many of you know what a heap is? As a data structure, not as a physical entity in memory. Okay. So, these terms, linked lists, heaps, all refer to ways of tracking data in a computer program and potentially ordering it and managing it in a computer program. Okay. So we're going to do a quick discussion of linked lists, which is probably the most common way of storing a list of indeterminate size. Because one thing in a simulation model is you don't know how many events are going to get added onto the queue, event list. If you think about a queue, you know that queues in general, they can be of any length. Okay, so in terms of events, any entity in the queue has generated some number of events. Okay, so that means that the list itself can be of any length. Now, again, the linked list is sort of one of the most standard ways of dealing with these queues of any length. If you're writing a linked list in C, which we're not going to, then you have to get into a detailed discussion of pointers and sort of physical memory locations. If you're using Java, well, essentially they have libraries that take care of all that for you. The underlying concept is actually the same. Okay, Java allows you to define these lists and navigate through them as you would sort of abstractly through a linked list. It just saves you from having to do the gory implementation details. Okay. So, a linked list is a way of producing a list in computer memory without having to resort to the physical location of the entries being significant. Okay, and what do I mean by that? Well, think about trying to implement the list as an array. So in an array, you have a sequence of locations that are one after the other, after the other, after the other. Okay. So there's a couple problems with this. One is that, well, if you don't know how long your list is, how big do you make your array? The second comes with sort of what you can do in the list. Okay. Now, suppose I have this is just a, you know, a list of, you know, my four best friends or whatever, three best friends, and I want to keep them in alphabetical order. So, again, if it's an array, I just put one after the other after the other. What happens if I want to add a new person to the list? Okay. So logically, Jane needs to go between Fred and Tim. If physical location is significant, then what happens is that I physically have to move where Tim is in the list and shove Jane in between. Okay. And this is complicated and inefficient. Again, think about having a million entries in the list, and you want to sort of change the second one or add, you know, a new second one. You'd have to move every single 999,998 of them to do that. Okay. So, what linked lists do is they free the list from relying on physical location. So now, physically, the members of the list can be stored anywhere, and we need to now indicate what their relationship is. Okay. So we've got all the members of the list here, but what we need to do to make it a list is put some ordering on it. So the first thing we're going to need to do is, well, where's the start of the list? Okay. And then, so this is the start of the list. Where's the next element? Okay, and so somehow we have to have a way of indicating the next element, and the next element, and the next element. Okay. So, now the elements of the list have to have two components. They have to have, well, what's their actual value? And they also have to have an indication of ordering. Okay, so we have to know that Albert is followed by Fred, is followed by Jane, is followed by Tim. So that's an additional piece of information that has to be stored for each member of the list. Okay. Again, if you were working in C, you would explicitly add a pointer. So add a little element that exactly pointed to the next element. Okay. In Java, essentially you're doing the same thing, it's just that Java gives you a bunch of constructs, so you don't add the pointer, Java does it for you. Okay. Okay, and the second handy element of this is that we can request space for each of these list members as we need it. Okay, so again, if we had the array, we were physically limited to whatever size we defined our array to. If you use something like a linked list, you can just keep adding in space as you need it. Okay. So, our list here is something very specific. It's a list of events, and I'm going to again assume that it's ordered. Okay, so we have the event that's going to occur next, followed by the event that occurs after that, followed by the event that occurs after that, etc. So, what operations are we going to need to do on this ordered list? Well, the first thing we said was we always looked at the first event or the next event to occur. That's fairly straightforward. That's, you pull off the first event in the list. Okay. As a consequence of examining this event, we're potentially going to have new events to add to the event list. Okay, now each of these new events will have a time of occurrence. If we're maintaining an ordered list, well, somehow we have to examine the elements of the list and decide where to insert our item. Okay, now this is where things get slightly less than satisfactory with linked lists, in that pretty much the only way to examine the elements of a linked list is start at the beginning and keep moving on through the list. Okay, so you can see that that's an operation that's, well, it's going to be a variable duration because it depends on how far through the list you have to go, how big is the list. Okay. And finally, again, potentially, you might be doing something similar with removing events. If you have conditional events in the sense that having an event occurs causes another event no longer to occur, that has to be yanked out of the list. Again, in that case, you have to examine the entire list to see if this event is actually in it. Okay. So the operations we need are, searching through a list, adding an element to a list, and removing an element from a list. So, again, these pictures are a little C-oriented, but suppose we want to add an element to a list. Well, again, what you have to do, well, somehow you have to find out where exactly in the list you want to add that element. In some cases, that will be the result of examining the values of the nodes. In some cases, you might actually have some information as to the node. Okay. And then, once you know where you want to insert your element, it's a matter of, again, changing these pointers, changing the ordering in the list. Okay. So, to begin with, our old node is pointing to is pointing to the next node. And obviously, if we want to put something in the middle of those two nodes, the old node is now going to have to point to the new node, and the new node is going to have to point to the one that was next in line. Okay. If you're doing this in C, you would literally be changing the values of these pointers. In Java, you'll be calling a method which essentially just, you tell it where to, you can, in Java you can keep track of where you are in a list, and you just say, oh well, insert something here. Okay, so it is easier in Java. But it's pretty much the same idea. You have to sort of know your position in the list and then change which node points to which. Okay. Similarly, if you're removing a node, then the active removal is, again, just changing the pointer structure or the next structure of your nodes. So the node previous to the one you're removing now has to point to the one after the one you're removing. Okay. And again, if you're doing dynamic allocation of space, this is then you'd want to free up that space as well. Okay. So removing from the beginning is a little bit easier. You just have to change the point, the initial pointer, to point to a different location. So, again, this is a fairly standard way of dealing with lists of indeterminate size. This is what I would recommend you use when you're doing your simulation assignment. Again, if you were doing it in C, you would have to write routines which manipulated these pointers. If you're doing it in Java, it's a little bit easier in the sense that there is a list iterator type which can be used to track where you are in your list and then perform a number of operations based on where you are, including sort of adding and removing nodes at a specific point. Okay. So you still have, in terms of operations, you still have the issue that if you're searching for the point to add or remove something, you still have to move through, examine the nodes one by one by one by one, so some sort of loop, and that can, again, be a sort of an operation of indeterminate duration. But Java makes it easier, once you found it, to actually add and remove things. Okay. I'm not going to go into the gory details of the linked list class. I've provided a reference down at the bottom, which gives you a fairly comprehensive discussion of what you can do, sort of in terms of adding and removing, and you know, code for how you do that. Okay. Okay. So again, this really is an implementation detail. I've spent time discussing it because it's going to be an important one when you go to do your assignment. Potentially, you could implement your list some other way, but again, this is a fairly standard way of implementing lists, and certainly if you're using Java, then you will have methods that will allow you to deal with sort of all of the operations that you need to do to perform for a linked list. Okay. This is not necessarily the most efficient way to store your data. And I've been sort of saying as we went along that, well, the primary problem with a linked list is in sorting, in accessing sort of specific pieces of data. If you want to find a specific piece of element of the list, you have to start at the beginning of the list and move along. Okay. It can be a bit problematic when you're trying to do something like order the list. Okay. So, if you're trying to insert items in order, then every time you insert an item, potentially you have to go the whole way through the list and examining each element as you go. Okay. Again, this is actually what I will recommend you do in your assignment. It's very straightforward, it's just not efficient. I just want to mention that if you get ambitious, then there are much more efficient ways of storing ordered lists, okay? And the heap structure is a classic, and again, because of the way you maintain the data in the heap, it will allow you to find sort of specific pieces of data, in particular, ordered pieces of data much faster. So it is quicker, but it's again a bit more complicated. We decided that we would prefer you to again just get sort of the basic elements into your assignment, and then worry about you can then go back and think about the details later if it's of interest to you. Okay. So that's sort of a major piece of implementation detail. As I said before, the second major piece is how are we generating our random numbers? If we have, for instance, time between arrival, an arrival event occurs, this immediately triggers another arrival event, the next arrival, and this happens at some random time. Well, when we, in our simulation, this will actually happen at a fixed time, right? So that's what we do, is we generate a specific time for the occurrence of the event. So the question is, how do we generate those times so that they adhere to some random distribution? And this is, we'll see, going to be a two-step process. Typically, you start by generating a number which is uniformly distributed. And what does it mean? It doesn't mean much to have a single number uniformly distributed. But if you generate a whole sequence of them, then the sequence is going to look random, and again be sort of, the values will be evenly drawn over some range. Okay. And once you've generated this uniformly distributed random sequence, then the next step is there are techniques for transforming this sequence into one of some other distribution. Okay. Now, again, in terms of your assignment, Java actually has a random method, and so you can use this as a basis, and it also has some specific distributions other than random that it'll allow you to use. If you're using something else, then you're going to have to code it. You're going to start with the random and then code it from there. Okay, so our first step is going to be generating a sequence of what we call pseudo-random numbers, and these numbers have the characteristic of being uniformly distributed over a range, and typically the range we look at will be 0 to 1. And they should also be statistically independent. Okay. And basically that's just saying that they are genuinely follow a random distribution. Okay. So, additionally, in some cases, it may be actually desirable that you can reproduce the sequence. Okay. And this is actually where the pseudo-random nature comes in. While any run that we generate, we want to be statistically independent and uniformly distributed, we will have a way of reproducing that run, which means if you know how you produce the first run, you can always produce the same run again and again and again. Okay. Once we have a uniform, a sequence of numbers that we're happy is uniformly distributed, then we can look at transforming those, or using those numbers to produce other numbers of other distributions. Okay. And so just in terms of terminology, we use the term random variance to refer to the actual numbers we produce. So a random variable is sort of, it's an abstraction that has a certain distribution attached to it. A variate is something, it was sort of specific instances of the, which are arranged in that distribution. Okay. So, again, there is no way of arguing that a single number is random or not random. You can only talk about randomness in the context of having observed some larger sample of numbers. Okay. Now, it is possible to produce genuinely random sequences. This is usually done by observing some natural phenomenon, radioactive emissions is one thing that's often used because they are genuinely random according to a certain distribution. Okay. First, our purposes, this is not the best way of doing it for a couple of reasons. One is that that's an expensive way to generate random numbers, and two, it's not a reproducible way. If you're trying to debug your simulation or sort of examine sort of specific phenomena, then you actually do want to be able to sort of run it again and again with the same set of numbers. Okay. The second way, therefore, of producing pseudo-random sequences is much more useful for us, and that is we have some mathematical algorithm. And that algorithm, it again has an initial condition. You'll hear these initial conditions referred to as seeds. And it transforms that initial condition into a sequence of numbers. And again, there's any number of ways to do this. People still sit down and think up algorithms for generating random numbers, and then they argue about how genuinely random their sequences are. So how many tests of randomness can their sequences pass? Okay. And these tests have to do with, again, arguing that there's no dependence among the numbers in the sequence. Yeah, the worst case of that would be if you knew the first number in the sequence and then you knew everything else. Well, that would be unfortunate. There's no real patterns, or there's no way that we can genuinely tell the difference between what we've generated and something that might be generated naturally. And that's the ideal. You never get, it's unlikely to get exactly to that ideal, but again, they're tests for sort of classifying how close you get to that ideal. Okay. Harry Peros describes a number of generators. Again, I don't want to go through them all because, again, I'm not going to ask you to write your own random number generator. It's not necessarily useful. Okay, it's good to be aware that somebody has written these and sort of what they look like basically. But again, in your case, you will probably go to Java and use what they provide for you. Okay. So, the goal, again, is going to be to produce this uniform distribution. I think the slide's actually out of order, but and over a specific range, in this case 0, 1. Okay. And you can work, so the density function is just 1 between 0 and 1 and 0 otherwise. And you can work out that this has an average of 1 half and a variance of 1 12th. Okay. Now, if we think about, again, just picking a observing a large sequence of these numbers, if they're all uniform, if they're all independent of each other, then you would expect the sequence to have other characteristics. And one of the ones that's used in tests for randomness is that you would expect, if you divided your interval up into a number of pieces, then each piece would have pretty much the same number of instances of the occurrences as the next. Okay. So you would expect, again, just if you observed a large number of these, you'd have as much falling into one interval as into any other interval. Okay. And obviously you also want it to be sort of independent of prior observations. Okay, so we're going to look at the very simple example given in Peros, which is a congruential random number generator, pseudorandom random number generator. Okay, and what you see that's nice about it is it's actually a quite simple formula. Okay, so the numbers are generated recursively. The next number is based on the previous number, but again, in a way that, without knowing the algorithm you used, you won't be able to detect the pattern. Okay, and so the actual formula is generically you can make your current number a function of any number of prior observations, and then you need to take it modulo some range. Okay. Again, in our very simple example, our current number, or the number we generate, is dependent. It's A times the previous number plus C mod M. Okay. And what we'll see in, so there's reasonably deep mathematics behind this. You can come up with a number of rules that are going to sort of tell you when you can generate a good sequence of random numbers from this. We'll see from the example we look at that picking just any values of A, C, and M is not necessarily going to get you anything terribly random. Okay. For our purposes, what we would want to be aware of is that there are values that people have proven to be reasonably good. And the 2 to the 32 is pretty much picked for computer reasons, because that would be the size of your computer memory. Okay. So, I guess the only other thing I'll say is that, again, the Java random is based on this simple formula, but again, picked with the right numbers to make it actually work in a random fashion. Okay, so we'll have a look at, we'll just, you know, something that, again, we can do out by hand. So we have our numbers, our initial condition, we have our seed would be x0, 0, and we picked values for A and C of 7 and M of 10. Okay. And what we see is that we can sequentially generate a list of numbers. Okay, so we have x0, and so you get 0 plus C is 7, or 0 plus 7 is 7, mod 10 is 7. Okay, so that's x1. 7 times 7 is 49, plus 7 is 56, mod 10 gives you 6. 7 times 6 is 42, plus 7 is 49, mod 10 is 9. 9 times 7 is 63, plus 7 is 70, mod M is 0. And what you see now is you're back where you started. Okay. And so you'll end up producing this relatively short sequence again and again and again. Okay, so what this gives you is an example of what you what sort of behavior you don't want your algorithm to exhibit. I observe a small number, in this case four numbers, the small portion of the sequence of four members of the sequence. And once I know that, I know the sequence from then on. That's not random. It's not independent at all. Okay. So, if you take the trouble to analyze the generators, then there's a few rules that you can always count on. No matter what you do, this will always produce a periodic sequence. What you'd like to do is know what the period is. So then if it's big enough, you make sure you end your generation before you go into a second period. Okay. So, the period is at most M, and if we respect a few conditions, then the period is exactly M. Okay. And so,
the conditions we would want are that M and C have no common divisors. A mod R is one where R is a prime factor of M, and A mod 4 is one if M is a multiple of 4. Okay. So it's just something you would, if you were writing a generator, you would at least want to ensure that you respect that value. Okay. So if we look at our values that we use, A, C, and A and C are 7 and M is 10, well, it's going to fail on the second one. What are the factors of M? 2 and 5. And obviously, A mod 5 is not going to be 1, it's going to be 2. Okay. So, again, there are ways of ensuring that your sequence is going to be reasonable. Okay. Now, if you look at a lot of the sort of what's written about random number generation in the context of simulation, the general advice is don't write your own random number generator, just because it is the mathematics in actually coming up with a good one is fairly deep. Okay. Lots of people have done it, so if you are going to write yours, just base it on what they've done. Okay, and there's, again, a lot out there that you can just use, and I think the Java one's probably okay anyway. Okay. So, again, that's a very simple way of generating random numbers, and again, there will be some well-known cases where you have some well-known values that have been shown to generate good sequences. There are more complex ways of generating random numbers. Again, Harry Peros goes through a whole bunch of them. I don't think it's that useful to do it unless, you know, again, you want to delve into the mathematical analysis of them, which again, in two lectures, I don't think is going to happen. Okay. There's a trade-off between complexity and suitability, so these algorithms become more complex. Hopefully with the complexity, you get better results, but again, as often observed, the complexity may just make it harder to decide whether your results are good or bad. Okay. So at worst, you could use a more complex algorithm which actually has not as good properties as the simple one, but you just can't necessarily compare. Okay. Now, again, one thing to do is just use one that's already been tested. Harry Peros says the advice, trust no one. If you're going to use somebody else's random number generator, then potentially you want to perform tests on the sequences that are generated. Again, he describes a whole bunch of tests. If there's time next time, I might sort of go over one of those tests with you, but again, they would be of the order of ensuring that the distribution is uniform, and then ensuring that there is no correlation, no dependence between various portions of the sequence that's generated. Okay, so the final topic we have here is, assuming that we have this sequence of uniformly distributed independent variates, how can we use that to generate other distributions, or variates with other distributions? And this is probably the sort of one bit of mathematics in this lecture that you actually have to sit down and think about.
And so seeing the way the time has gone, I will defer that till next lecture. Okay, the notes are there. You can have a look at it and see if it makes sense, but we'll talk about it next time. I forgot. Okay, again, Java. Java has a random class, which it'll be the easiest way for you to get random variables. It generates uniform distributions either between 0 and 1 or as integers between some specified range. It will also generate some other distributions such as the normal distribution. Again, I've provided a reference that discusses this in some reasonable detail. The nice thing about Java as well is that you can always just go to the Sun site, and they do have sort of extensive discussions of all of their classes. So if you know that a class exists, you just look it up on the Java site, and it will give you all the methods and everything that can happen that can be done for that class and in a fairly straightforward way. Okay, so again, we'll take up the idea of how you transform this uniform distribution into some other distribution next time. And again, next time will be pretty much all maths. We'll be looking at how you interpret the outputs of simulations, and statistically, how can you convince yourself that what you're observing is actually representative of the system behavior. And so, have a good bank holiday weekend, and I'll see you next time.